So they provide it?
They do.
They provide the bike.
Yeah.
We're going to call to order the House Policy Transportation Committee.
My endorsement.
And we're happy to see all of you here today. As you know, this is an informational meeting, and we are here to catch up on some of the important issues in our transportation system in the state of Oregon. So thank you for all being here today. Our first item, we're going to open an informational item on the major transportation project update. And we welcome Paul Mathis from the Highway Division here to help us through this presentation and update. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I'm going to walk you through just some of the work that we've got coming up this summer. I'm going to focus on the summer construction season, some of the major projects. I'll touch on a few projects that we're working on, getting ready for future seasons, especially those that are came out of House Bill 2017. But most of my remarks will be about what you're going to experience this summer from a construction standpoint. Okay, I'm going to start in the Portland area. Portland area, we're going to see a number of projects, not just this summer, but for the next several construction seasons. Many of the projects that were in House Bill 2017 are a few years out, and so we've been staggering and sequencing projects in a way to get some of the work out of the way in preparations for those projects that were in the bill. The projects that I'm going to touch on today are on the insert of that map. Starting on US 26, touch on some widening we're doing, finishing up there. I-5 North, we're doing a major paving project there. I-205 is another major paving project with some auxiliary lanes, and you probably, those of you traveling south out of Portland, have probably experienced the work on I-5 south of 217 that we're doing. The major work I'll talk about there is where that blue dot is, where we're going to be doing some major bridge rehabilitation right where I-5 and I-84 come together. First project out on Highway 26. This is where we're completing three lanes on US 26 beyond 185th. If you remember the Jobs and Transportation Act, we had funding to complete three lanes out to 185th. We actually had savings on this project as well as other projects in Washington County. Partnered with Washington County, we're able to fund further work out to Cornelius Pass. This project is just wrapping up. We'll be doing final lift paving the next month or two, and it will be complete. There's a picture of some of the work as that third lane terminates there at Cornelius Pass Road. I-5 North paving is a major project. It's actually a two-season project that will get started. Most of this work will be done at night. There is one major exception to that, and that's some bridge work that will happen just south of 405 on I-5, where we'll actually have to close the freeway for a weekend and do bridge deck work on that work. There's a lot of coordination between the work that is underway here as well as the project I mentioned earlier with the ramps between I-5 and I-84 where they come together. You can notice on here, these four ramps right here are the four that I'll be talking about that take you between I-5 and I-84. Each one of those ramps are going to be closed completely for about 2 weeks apiece. They're going to start after the 4th of July, and we'll sequence one after another. And if you can imagine how much congestion that we have there on a normal day, this will exacerbate that considerably and have traffic difficulties. In our process, well, there's a picture of the work that we'll be doing. The work is basically taking the deck off that was originally poured in 1964, taking that off and pouring a brand new deck. Has to be done all in one sequence just from the vibration of traffic and so forth, and the summer months with the rain. We've coordinated this work with the major events centers around the area, Rose Quarter and others, to time these in a way that we miss the major events that they have scheduled. Once we had the sequencing and those dates down, we began working with our local partners, specifically TriMet and City of Portland, and try to find different options, additional enhanced bus routes, as well as city streets for people to travel on. We'll also be closing some of the on-ramps to I-84 just to limit congestion that will be happening in that area. What you're going to see in a few weeks, starting next month, is a major kind of blitz campaign media information out to the public and inform them of their options that they have, the exact dates, now that we have the contractor on board, and do a major outreach with this, with the work that's going on. Next project I'm going to talk about is I-5 South. So this is a another major repaving project that starts actually at Highway 99W and goes south all the way to I-205. If you've traveled this section recently, you see the work that's been underway. This work will also add an additional lane, what we call an auxiliary lane. That's what the dash lines there in the diagram are for southbound. When this work is complete, as you exit 217 southbound on I-5, you'll have a dedicated lane that will take you all the way to an exit-only lane onto I-205. That's partially complete today up to Lower Boones Ferry, but this will complete that work and will be a major help in the area, relieving some of the congestion that we see. This work was originally to be a two-year project. We work with the contractors to accelerate that work to be completed this season. There's a picture of some of the work that you see underway there. Similarly, on I-205, another major repaving project, this time from the Glen Jackson Bridge all the way south to Johnson Creek Boulevard. Those dashed hash lines in there are, again, additional lanes, auxiliary lanes that we're going to be installing or building. One there north, just north of I-84 on I-205, and then a couple there in the Powell Division areas. I've got a short video I'm going to show you here in a second that outlines just exactly where those are. There's a picture of some of the work underway, and if I can pull this off.
The Oregon Department of Transportation is in the planning and design phase for a project to improve transportation and safety on I-205 between Johnson Creek Boulevard and the Glen Jackson Bridge. ODOT will repave this 9-mile stretch of freeway, some on and off ramps, and intersections. New auxiliary lanes will be constructed and a stormwater facility will be expanded. New auxiliary lanes will be constructed in both directions to improve traffic flow and safety along I-205. These lanes provide a direct connection on the freeway from one interchange ramp to the next. Auxiliary lanes allow mixing of different traffic speeds when vehicles are entering and exiting the freeway. They do not add capacity to the freeway, but they can improve traffic flow and significantly reduce crashes at bottleneck locations. A northbound auxiliary lane will be constructed from the ramp where eastbound I-84 enters northbound I-205 to the Killingsworth Street off-ramp. This area has one of the highest crash rates in Oregon, due in large part to short merging and weaving distances where lower speed traffic entering and leaving the freeway mixes with high speed through traffic. The new auxiliary lane will provide longer merging and weaving distances, providing a direct connection from I-84 traffic bound for Sandy Boulevard and Killingsworth Street, greatly improving safety and traffic flow in the area. A second northbound auxiliary lane will be constructed from Powell Boulevard to westbound I-84. This entrance to exit lane will provide safer connection from I-205 traffic bound for Stark Street, Washington Street, Gleason Street, and westbound I-84. A southbound auxiliary lane will also be constructed from the ramp where eastbound I-84 enters southbound I-205 to the Division Street Powell Boulevard exit. Due to the current on and off ramp conflicts, this area has some of the worst bottlenecks in the corridor. The auxiliary lane will provide longer merging distances and allow I-84 traffic to access the Division Powell exit without having to merge with the through traffic on I-205. It is expected to reduce crashes in the area by as much as 30%. These auxiliary lanes were identified as a cost-effective way to improve safety and reduce congestion. Thank you for your patience as we continue to improve Portland's highway system.
What was the timeline on that one?
Make sure I can get out of this. So it's a two-year construction project. Get back to my. Sorry, Madam Chair. It's a two-year construction project. The current project will build the north auxiliary lane from I-84 north, as well as the southbound one. The northbound one will be a separate contract for next year. The northbound auxiliary lane is what we call a trigger project, is one that was built into House Bill 2017 that we had to have open to trigger the next 2-cent increase in the gas tax.
Well, it's a lot of work.
Yes.
And everybody's going to love you when it's done.
Yeah, it's about a $60 million project in total.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
And I think one of the things, Mr. Mather, to point out about this particular project is that it leaves a glaring gap in a real problem in this area, and that is the I-84 eastbound to 205 northbound transition, which is the airport transition essentially for much of the west side, and that off-ramp and then merge back on to 205 has become literally miles back up now for much of the day. So I'm hoping that as we, I appreciate that this is not the not the purpose of this conversation. Your update is appreciated, but as we look at this area here, we need to make sure we've got that one covered.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Vile, I think you'll see with these improvements, you'll see some improvements to the operation of this whole segment of the freeway as we implement all three of these. Now, will it solve everything for every hour of the day? No, but it will improve the operations. And it said in the video, one of the benefits that we see from these is the reduction of crashes, and each one of those crashes can have ripple effects throughout the corridor. And so by reducing those amount of crashes, we'll have an immense benefit to the operations.
The area I'm talking about is that underpass, however, that has to be navigated before you get back on to 205 North. And that's where the slowdown is occurring.
So from you're going from I-84.
I-84 through the underpass onto 205 North.
Yeah, so this auxiliary lane in this area will improve that operation. This red dashed area that you're talking about here, as you're headed from Washington County, I-84, and you're headed to the airport, you're going to have an extra lane to travel all the way through to Killingsworth to improve that merge area in that section.
Okay. I'll work on my vision of that.
Okay, so moving on to, I think what we're setting the stage for, again, I've alluded to a couple times the major projects that are built into House Bill 2017. The projects on Oregon 217, both southbound and northbound, we have similar projects that I've described with auxiliary lanes in those sections. The southbound project is about a $44 million project in 2021, and then 2023 there's a $55 million project for the northbound section that is funded in the bill. The Rose Quarter project is another one that's dependent on additional fund that's triggered in the 2022 increase, where we have $30 million that's bonded for that project. We're required to bring to you a cost to complete report on that project by the end of the year. If you remember, we were in front of you a few months ago talking about the cost to complete for 205 project, and so that has been complete. We'll do a similar body of work for the Rose Quarter project. Okay, so turning on to Eugene, we have a similar story on a little different scale in Eugene. A number of projects that are going on this summer and next summer. We've wrapped up the Jobs and Transportation Act project at I-5 and the Beltline, that is in this area right here. If you've driven through Eugene, we've just wrapped that project up. We actually had savings from that project that we move over to the Beltline Delta interchange, and next year we'll be doing a project in that area to improve the operations. That green line on there is what we're doing this summer, is a project to repave essentially the entire Beltline highway. That project is just getting underway this month. Later this summer we'll begin repaving a project where the red area is there on Oregon 126 that will go from essentially West Eugene on out to Veneta. We have some maintenance paving in there. We also, as I described in the Portland area, we have some major bridge rehabilitation work. We have one on the Beltline that will take place next summer, and then one this summer and next summer, an $18 million project that will be a seismic upgrade as well as bridge rehabilitation that will close several of those on-ramps periodically to do the work. Moving on south to the Rogue Valley, the Highway 62 Expressway. This is one I've talked in front of the committee before. This is likely to be our last completed Jobs and Transportation Act project, scheduled to have a ribbon cutting in December of this year. The First phase of this project is the southern portion of it. I got some pictures of it here. It's just wrapping up. There's some of the new alignment work, but the entire corridor is projected to be open after this construction season, probably in about December is what we're thinking. Another bridge project in southern Oregon, I'm sure Representative Wilson is very familiar with, is the Caveman Bridge Project, one we've been working on a number of months. I've had some closures and impacts of traffic already. Grants Pass is having their Boatnik project or festival this weekend, and so we're going to have the bridge open for those events as well as the county fair later on this year. But we do have 12 complete closures of the bridge that will be scheduled as the contractor continues to work on rehabilitating that bridge. In Central Oregon, this is a project that was funded out of House Bill 2017. This is a roundabout project just out of Prineville. If you're familiar where the new Facebook plan is and the Les Schwab is, kind of before you drop down into Prineville on 126. We found great success with the roundabouts in these transition areas where we're transitioning from high-speed rural down to urban speeds. We've built one in Forest Grove and one in Sisters, and we expect similar success here. This one was particularly challenging in that this is a major freight corridor for overdimensional loads, and so we had to work closely with industry to ensure our design here accommodated those loads that use this corridor. Currently, we actually went out to the fairgrounds, laid out in cones our design, and had them drive it to ensure that they were able to navigate what we were going to be building. This project should be complete in July, so they're well underway in getting this project moving.
Can I ask a question about that one?
Yeah.
Who's building it? Do we have a partner, or are we building it with a contractor?
Madam Chair, we're building with a contractor, and the name escapes me. It's a newer contractor I'm not familiar with.
It's just the roundabout in Forest Grove, you know,
yes.
Because it is a rural or transition area, you know, there were some issues about how many inches we needed to get tractors and different things in that roundabout. So I want to say this every time I see a roundabout. Let's check with, you know, making sure we've got all of the contractors and the local government that sometimes are partners in doing the work, you know, really are on the same page as far as those designs, because there was a problem with the last one that was built in Forest Grove. And now they're driving, you know, kind of on the site, you know, on part of the other, we want to call it a sidewalk, but
Madam Chair, the one in Forest Grove was actually designed and built by the county. We work with them, as you know.
Right.
This one, actually, we're doing the design and administering the contract with the contractor. And we actually, again, we went out to the fairgrounds, laid out the design, worked through it.
That's so perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Picture of the work that's underway. Lastly, just touch on some of the impacts we've seen in the gorge over the winter. Those of you traveling to eastern Oregon have probably noticed some of the lane closures that we've had in this area. They're really because of two projects. One is a slide repair project just outside of Cascade Locks, where we had a permanent lane closure. That permanent lane closure has been lifted. We'll have some kind of daily lane closures throughout the summer, but we'll be able to avoid, obviously, weekends and Fridays as the heavier traffic periods for that project. There's a picture of some of the work going on there. And finally, we're building one of the last segments of the historic Columbia River Highway State Trail project. So this is rebuilding the old highway around Shell Rock Mountain. That's in the center of the picture there. And we've had a lane closure to allow that work to happen. That permanent lane closure, again, has been lifted. And now we have temporary one. There's a picture of some of the work that's underway. You can see the barrels in there. Those barrels are moved, lane closures when they're working, but able to keep traffic moving. Again, they're in those peak hours in the summertime. Lastly, just touch on work zone safety. May is work zone safety month, and we've done a campaign. You may have seen some of our press conferences and media releases that we've had just to bring that attention to motorists. Work zones are not only dangerous for our workers, but also for motorists, and trying to encourage people to stay off their cell phones, pay attention going through work zones, and just respect the area that you're working through, somebody's work area.
Are there any questions for staff on any of these projects, or any questions on the update for the summer? Okay. Well, Paul, I want to personally thank you for the presentation today, but also I understand this might be close to the end of your meeting schedule. So I understand that you're on your way to, you know, better things.
Yes, so thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate working with you and members of the committee. It's been a pleasure.
And that's why I chose not to harass Mr. Mather today.
We wanted you to go out easy, right? Okay. But thank you so much. I've seen your work over the years, and it's marvelous, and we're going to miss you a great deal.
Good.
And you better make sure that you change your phone number, because people will be calling and say, Paul, how did we do this?
Yeah.
How did we get here?
Yeah.
So, but thank you
Good.
Very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, you guys are quiet today, so let's see if we can get anything else exciting for you coming up. So we're going to go into, again, some more updates, and we're going to talk a little bit, I believe, at this time about some other updates. And are you going to start with the Portland Metro Region congestion pricing?
That's correct.
So welcome, Travis. Thank you for being here, and you're bringing your expert partner. So thank you and welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Travis Brower. I'm ODOT's assistant director, and I am here to talk to you about Portland Metro Area Value Pricing and the Continuous Improvement Advisory Committee. My trusty sidekick, Mr. Gard, will be talking about the Statewide Transportation Improvement Fund. And I should note that Oregon Transportation Commission Chair Tammy Bainey is in the audience today. She wanted to join us today show the alignment between ODOT and the Transportation Commission as we implement HB 2017. The legislature obviously gave the commission very significant responsibilities in overseeing and delivering key aspects of that legislation. So she is here if there are any particular questions about some of the issues that we're doing, but we are working very closely with them. So I will start by walking you through where we are going with the Portland Metro Area value pricing work that is required under HB 2017. I think it was very clear during the last legislative session and to anyone who drives in Portland that congestion is a very large and growing problem in the Portland metro area. Just from 2013 to 2015, the regional hours of congestion increased by 14%, and the daily hours of traffic delay increased by 23%. And since 2015, it's only gotten a lot worse. Recognizing that, in HB 2017, the legislature really tried to tackle congestion relief and took what I call an all-of-the-above approach to addressing this. So you obviously funded some of the bottleneck relief projects that Mr. Mather just discussed with you. You provided additional transportation options for people to be able to ride their bike or take a bus. So they don't have to get in their car for some trips. You also provided funding for freight rail to try to move some trucks off the road and provide more capacity. And you gave us direction to start using value pricing as one of the tools in our congestion relief toolbox, as many other regions of the country and states have done in recent years. The direction from the legislature was to do a feasibility analysis of value pricing on I-5 and I-205 and to apply to the Federal Highway Administration by the end of this calendar year for authority to implement tolling on these corridors. There are two different types of value pricing that we are exploring under this, because the legislation didn't give a specific direction about which of these or both. So we're looking at both bridge and highway tolling and managed toll lanes. When you do bridge and highway tolling, you're tolling all the lanes. And this has typically been used across the country as a way to finance infrastructure. But it is also a very effective way to address congestion by both managing demand and, in some cases, increasing capacity by funding additional roadway capacity. When we talk about managed toll lanes, what we're looking at is tolling one or two, sometimes three, lanes of a highway. And that basically gives people the choice. If they want to have a more reliable, faster, less congested trip, they can pay the toll and take that lane. That's a picture of the I-405 express toll lane in the Seattle metro region. That facility operates at 45 miles per hour about 90% of the time, which I think most people in the Portland metro region would kill to be going 45 miles per hour most of the time. The Transportation Commission is firmly in the driver's seat. In fact, the direction for this work is to the Transportation Commission, not to ODOT. And so the Transportation Commission last August decided to set up a policy advisory committee to advise them to really dig in deeply on this topic. And most importantly, to get the voices from everyone across the region so that we can develop a value pricing proposal that will actually work for the region, that will reduce congestion and address other needs in the region and address some of the concerns that we hear regularly about equity and the impact on middle class and working class Oregonians. The commission created a very broad policy advisory committee. It's chaired by two of our commissioners, Alondo Simpson and Sean O'Halloran. It has representatives from local governments across the region, all four counties in the Portland-Vancouver metro region, as well as stakeholder groups, the business community, and community organizations as well, particularly those that represent people who might be disproportionately impacted because they're lower-income individuals. We have supplemented that PAC work with a very extensive public participation effort because we recognize we need to engage everyone and make sure everyone's voices are heard in this overall process. So to date, we have held, I believe, six or seven in-person open houses, supplemented by two online open houses. More than 13,000 people have participated in those online open houses. We've had more than 24,000 people view our video. 2,600 people have taken the video and or taken the survey, and so on and so forth. We presented numerous community groups, and there's been a particular effort in this to engage some of the lower income communities in the region and also start working through the policy implications. How can we address some of those concerns around equity and the impact to lower and middle income and middle class Oregonians? As a result of this work with the public and the Policy Advisory Committee, they provided good feedback to the consultant team of certified smart traffic tolling people that we hired. The consultants looked at both corridors, at both the managed lanes and the bridge and highway tolling, and came up based on a pretty good analysis they did at five concepts across these highways. I'm going to walk you through each of these really briefly and give you sort of the high-level findings. They just presented these last week to our PAC and then got some feedback, and they presented a recommendation that I'll talk you through as well. So concept A is priced lanes on Northern I-5. So this would price one lane in each direction and maintain two unpriced lanes in each direction. When the consultants did the analysis, what they found is that pretty cheap to implement. Also doesn't raise a whole heck of a lot of money. In fact, it's not even clear we would be covering the operations cost, much less the capital cost of this, even with the highest toll of any of the scenarios here. The kicker really is, really didn't do anything to reduce congestion. So that one is not one that the consultants recommended moving forward. The second concept, concept B, is to toll on I-5 between Multnomah Boulevard, just south of downtown, and Going Street, Alberta Street, on the north end of the Central Business District. What they found on this one is that there was a really strong potential for congestion reduction. This is one of the most congested portions of the corridor, one of the more congested portions of any corridor in the United States. It, surprisingly, I think, for many folks, it had relatively modest diversion to I-205. Part of that was that there's so much congestion through that section. You've already got a boatload of people who are diverting to I-205 to avoid that section of the freeway. And what was really interesting as well is significant revenue generation on this particular proposal. So that was one the consultants recommended to move forward on. The third concept, concept C, this is toll the whole darn thing. This is the recommendation that they looked at that would generate the greatest congestion reduction and travel time savings and a boatload of revenue as well, as you can imagine, because you're tolling it in many points across the system. However, no one in the country has ever tried to implement tolling in this sort of way by just doing the whole darn thing at once. And so the consultant said, yeah, you know, there's a lot of people who are interested in this in the long term, but they would not recommend doing that as the first move out of the gate, perhaps as a long-term phased-in application of tolling if the initial work works out. The fourth is another managed lane proposal on I-205. This is the section from I-205, or from the Stafford Road to the Abernathy Bridge, where there's only two lanes in each direction. It's really the last two-lane section within the metro region. This is a section that we believe does need to have some additional capacity to address congestion there. So they looked at just tolling one additional lane in each direction. This would have a relatively high toll, relatively minimal diversion to any other routes, but the kicker again, minimal congestion reduction, because in the end, building those two new lanes would provide most of the congestion relief you would need. Perhaps even more importantly, the fatal flaw on this one is that we have no way to build these lanes currently. There's no revenue provided by HB 2017 to build these, and the toll would not even come close to paying for the capital costs.
Representative Vile.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's where I'm really curious. Why don't we set the toll at a level that actually would fund the lanes and let that be a test case to see if it's not going to work for us?
Yeah, Chair McLean, Representative Vile, in this case, when you have just a single lane that's tolled, the higher you set the toll rate, the fewer people use it.
Sure.
And so in those cases, there's high elasticity of demand, as you can imagine. And so there is what they oftentimes will call a revenue maximizing toll rate, which for these priced lanes is usually relatively low. Most of these are not done to maximize revenue. For example, that I-405 express toll lane in Bellevue on the east side of Lake Washington is set at a rate to maximize throughput, but not to maximize revenue. And they actually did not pay for that project using the toll revenues. They're getting some surplus revenue above and beyond the cost of operations, but for the most part, these managed toll lanes are not considered revenue generators. I don't know anywhere in the country that's actually been able to use a managed toll lane to pay for itself.
Actually, I'm reading now the opposite in some of the managed toll lanes, and the reason is because the congestion has just simply gotten so bad that people are saying, I don't care what it costs. I got to get through this in 10 minutes versus 45.
Okay, so I'm going to make a suggestion, and that is that you finish the five, and then we come back and ask some more detailed questions. And I will just put something out there for you. You talked about bleeding off in one of the suggestions, but not diversion in all of the gotcha. Suggestions. So can you please maybe add diversion to the rest of the ones you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So as you can imagine, concept C, which is tolling the whole thing, not a lot of diversion because you're not going to escape the toll by going somewhere else, except that there might be diversion in this case to other state highways or to local roads, but you're not going to divert between the two corridors. In the case of concept D, there's going to be minimal diversion because people who don't want to pay will just use the general purpose lanes. Concept E was another concept that was tested more for revenue potential. This would be to toll all lanes of the highway at the Abernathy Bridge. This one was found to provide pretty substantial congestion reduction and travel time savings for drivers on I-205. There is some traffic diversion to I-5, particularly for freight. I would note that the potential for diversion would be reduced if we end up tolling on both routes, because then through traffic would not be able to use the untolled route. This one is interesting in the sense that it likely generates sufficient revenue to fund the entirety of the Abernathy Bridge widening and seismic retrofit project, as well as potentially a significant portion of the widening between Stafford Road and the bridge. So based on these analysis by the consultant, they recommended, as I mentioned, the section of I-5 in the Central Business District, as well as this Abernathy Bridge tolling, as the most likely options that they thought should move forward with looking at that system-wide tolling in the long term. They did not recommend either of the managed lane projects simply for the fact that they didn't meet the objective of providing congestion relief in the region. And I don't want to go past where the PAC conversation went, but based on the conversation that the PAC had last week, it appears that there isn't significant opposition to those two options moving forward. They seem to be coalescing at some level around those two. While certainly there is no unanimity or full consensus on what should move forward. But we do have one additional PAC meeting. The next steps moving forward.
Can I stop you right there for just a minute, make sure we don't have any other questions. I do want you to bring up the fact that, you know, you have a deadline at the end of this particular year, and I'm sure you're going to get into that. But one of the things you didn't mention, again, on all five, and I'm sure the consultants thought about it, and that is, you know, what do we know about the application process, and what do we need to make sure that we can be successful at the application process so any of these five can be successful and or assist in the congestion relief projects that we're hoping for?
Yeah, absolutely. And to answer that question, Representative McClain, Federal Highway Administration is sitting around the table, and we have engaged them very deeply. We've brought them out for a workshop. We've been talking to the program manager. We've been talking to them back in Washington, D.C., where the decisions will be made. On the if the Abernathy Bridge project was to move forward, that one's actually relatively easy in the sense that it is allowed outright under federal law to toll bridges when you reconstruct or replace them. So that one won't require really any special dispensation from the federal government. The other one that the consultant recommended of tolling through I-5 through Central Portland would require approval by the Federal Highway Administration under the Value Pricing Pilot Program, which allows states to implement more wide-ranging tolling options. There is some possibility that the Federal Highway Administration could look more favorable on that because it does tie into that section of freeway that will be widened as part of the Rose Quarter. So it ties to the ability to toll widened freeways. And in addition, we have seen that the administration and USDOT in general has been very favorable in their view of tolling. So we think that given all that we've done to grease the skids and the dispensation of our federal partners, that we are at least reasonably optimistic that we may be able to get approval on these.
Representative Bile.
So the one aspect I didn't hear was timing, the idea that we would toll only during high occupancy periods, reinforcing the idea that we've got 30 to 40% non-essential trips taking place right now that could be diverted to other times.
Yeah.
What happened with that discussion?
Chairman McClain, Representative Vile, that's definitely part of what will be involved in the toll rate setting process. Under Oregon statute, the Oregon Transportation Commission is the toll rate setting body, and so they will be, should we be given permission by the federal government to move forward, will be examining those different toll rate structures. In any situation, I believe it's very likely that we would have, at the very least, higher toll rates at peak hours as a demand management tool, much as like we proposed with the I-5 bridge replacement, of having higher toll rates at the peak hours and then much lower rates at some of the off-peak hours. So there is the possibility that you could leave a section of highway untolled during the off-peak hours, say perhaps, you know, 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. or something like that, or even during the middle of the day. But that's a discussion. Once we have a little bit more detail as we delve into each of these corridor segments and learn a little bit more of the traffic patterns and how they'll respond to the toll rates.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So I'm thinking again of even something in that Central Portland corridor or even over on 205, where maybe we didn't toll all lanes like you've got shown in Central Portland, but maybe toll only one lane and only during congestion environments. And you don't have to spend any more money necessarily other than on the infrastructure of the readers, et cetera, just so we can test the concept that in fact that does encourage more efficient use for the non-essential trips.
Yes, so Chair McClain, Representative Vile, the consultants looked at managed lanes on the entirety of both corridors, and when they did that initial analysis, really the only two places they thought they might make sense were on that north portion of I-5, here, and then on I-205 on that section. So they didn't find, at least on that initial analysis, any locations where they felt like the managed lanes would add significant value. So that's where they they recommended these particular five concepts as at least the initial ones to evaluate.
And those actually were the two that I have been thinking were most likely as well. But you're telling me that the feasibility didn't pan out?
Yes, both the feasibility in terms of the congestion relief was simply did not meet the goal of providing congestion relief. And more importantly, with this concept D, where we are talking about tolling two new lanes, one in each direction, and don't have the resources to build either of those lanes. So it's about between Stafford Road and the Abernathy Bridge, that entire section costs about $500 million in additional highway expansion and rehabilitation costs for the bridge that we simply don't have programmed. And as a result, we would need to find some revenue source to build those lanes before we could even use value pricing on them.
Well, Manager, one last comment. It doesn't look like this is going to do much for our congestion problems on any of the scenarios that you've outlined. And like the conclusion we come to is we've got to build another road in this part of the country.
So I'll call that an editorial, and thank you very much for it. And then I don't want staff to get discouraged, because we still want to try and see how far we can go with this idea. And remembering that we do have some deadlines in December that we have in our bill. And thanking Tammy for all the hard work she's going to be doing between now and December. And we can have more conversations, and you're welcome to come to our September meeting and have a formal time to present if you'd like to do that. I also, are there any other questions before we let them go on with the schedule that we do have? Okay, then on we go.
All right, so as I mentioned, there's one more PAC meeting, the sixth meeting on June 25th. We're all eagerly awaiting that to find out what their recommendation is on the location type of congestion pricing and the mitigation strategies that should go along with that. That will go to the Transportation Commission. They're going to hold a special meeting in Portland on July 12th during a formal public comment period. We figured there'd be a couple people who want to talk to this, so we figured we should give them an opportunity to do so. And then the Transportation Commission will provide feedback to the ODOT team that's working on this with the goal of going to the November Transportation Commission for approval of the application to the Federal Highway Administration. That's important because there was direction in our budget bill in the form of a budget note to explore whether congestion pricing could pay for the I-205 widening from Stafford Road to the Abernathy Bridge, and report back to you in the final legislative days of the year before that application to FHWA, which is due December 31st. And I've become fond of saying that this is not the beginning of the end. This is only the end of the beginning once we get to that point, because at that point, we will be engaging with our federal partners in securing their approval for this work. That could be a protracted process. As you can imagine, they want to see a very deep level of analysis. There may be a few more things we need to do. And then, more importantly, we will need to undertake likely the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, process, particularly if it's tied to projects in those areas, as well as developing toll systems, toll policies. There's likely going to be legislation that we need to ensure that we have adequate toll enforcement authority within statute, and probably a few other things as well. So this will be a long process before you will actually see tolls on Oregon roads.
So I just want to let you know that, you know, as we're talking about this, this really is just an initial update, and we'll have plenty of time if you want to bring back a particular issue in the September for more discussion at those legislative days, that we certainly can do that with direction on some of the questions that you have. Yes, please, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just left with the impression from our presentation that none of these five alternatives seems to hold promise for reducing traffic congestion. Did my intake of the information that was delivered miss something here, because if that's accurate, To what end and why are we proceeding?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not the expert, so I'm just going to say that that's not what I heard, and so I'll ask our expert to respond to that. But I think that with the short initial piece of information that you've given us today, that probably the report that you're going to be getting or you got from the mm-hmm. from the folks, that maybe, can you share that with us?
So yes, we could, absolutely.
Yeah, we could read more of the details on each one because I didn't hear that.
Yeah, so Chairman Klain, Representative Witt, the consultant's analysis did find that both of the two concepts that they recommended moving forward do have pretty significant congestion reduction benefits. So concept B, the central I-5 tolling, they do predict would have a very significant increase in travel times and speeds. And in fact, what the consultants have told us is we have what they call hyper congestion, so that essentially it is so congested that the freeway's throughput just collapses. And they predict that even with tolling, we will get more vehicles through faster by using pricing. The same went for concept E. While they looked at it primarily for revenue potential, they did indicate that congestion reduction and travel time savings for drivers on I-205 would be significant. And just as importantly, using that tolling to finance the bottleneck relief on that corridor would provide additional capacity that could then further reduce congestion. So I think we do have two options on the table here that do have significant potential for untying some of that horrible traffic.
Representative Witt, did you have a follow-up?
Well, only that I guess I didn't hear correctly the initial presentation on option E, because I thought I had heard initially that option E really didn't have the desired effect. I must have missed that, and I'm glad to hear that there's some hope out into the future. I would agree with Representative Vile that there are other alternatives, and we ought to be considering them. So.
So I'm going to go to Representative Vile next, but I want to thank staff for the presentation. And I cheated just a little bit by looking at the report, and have had a few other additional folks kind of give me some ideas of what the people who did this report stated and why they thought a couple of them had better potential. And so I really think it would be helpful to all of us to get that report and make sure that folks have a chance to kind of read it on their own, and then we might have more pointed questions in September on our ledge days at that time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet. Representative Vile.
My apologies in advance, Madam Chair.
Okay, here we go again.
But I've spent 30 years watching Metro make projections about population growth in Washington County, and sitting as the County Planning Commission Chair, those population growth projections coming in below what actually happens time and time and time again. Projections on how many people are going to ride Metro, are going to ride transit versus drive on the roads, and that's going to solve our problem. Again, the projections haven't come true. I just don't believe this. I do believe that if you add a lane on the Abernathy Bridge and you toll the whole thing, yeah, you'll help congestion because you have an extra lane. But if you don't add a lane in that central portion of Portland corridor and all you do is toll it, where are they going to go if they don't pay the toll? And even if they do pay the toll, they're still on it. Does it mean that they may go at a different time of day? Yes, that's possible if you time the tolling. But I just have to challenge the presumption that tolling that is going to relieve congestion. To me, it's just going to back it up further on both sides of that congested area, and or it's going to dump it over onto one of the side roads that's already just as bad. So. Travis, I apologize for really throwing out that challenge, but I think it has to be answered.
Yeah, Chairman Klain, Representative Vile, that's exactly the sort of analysis we need to do on each of these in a lot greater depth. as we move forward. So for that Central Portland option, that's one of the things we are concerned about, is whether that just does divert people to local roads. So far, the analysis has not shown that. In general, the thought behind value pricing is that first you move people away from the peak periods, you know, with a higher price on that, to less congested time. So there's diversion in time. There's also some diversion in routes, which can be beneficial in some ways. If you're moving trips that shouldn't be on the freeway onto local roads where they should take place, there's nothing wrong with that. However, if you're moving freight traffic, for example, from the freeway onto a local road, that may be a problem. And then, of course, there's an incentive for diversion to other modes of transportation, like transit, so that with a price on using the road, there is perhaps some folks who will start using public transportation or other modes. So those are the sort of effects we could see under each of these scenarios. And again, you know, that initial analysis does show that you will have some of those effects on that one. And in particular, just the greater efficiency of the road by ending that hyper congestion at peak periods, you will actually be able to move more vehicles rather than fewer.
Thank you. Representative Evans?
Thank you, Chair. My question will be very brief. I, and truly, I'm not trying to set a bear trap here. I'm just curious. When I left to go get some coffee about this, I was still confused, and so here I go. Why do we call it value pricing instead of tolling? Like, I mean, I'm not that bright, but I can figure it out. And I'm pretty sure that the people that are going to someday have to pay tolling if we do this are going to know it's tolling.
Yep.
So can we just, like, please?
Chair McClain, Representative Evans, that's something we've struggled with this entire time. The HB 2017 language specifically says value pricing, so we tried to maintain some fidelity to the legislative direction and use that term in the more formal sense. We also talk about congestion pricing and tolling, and we don't want to make it look like we're pulling the wool over anybody's eyes, because we recognize the public sees this is tolling.
And here's why I say that. Earlier, ODOT came in, you talked about, Paul reported, you got a project done before the time and under price. I mean, like, right now, ODOT has a good reputation. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're trying to pull a little over people's eyes. I just think that it's a big enough problem that sometimes we create problems with the public when we don't need to. So I just want to put that out there.
Mm-hmm. Before I go to Representative Witt, I just want to make one comment, and that is that at least in some definitional ways, the difference between tolling and value pricing that I've heard is that tolling's on a facility and building the facility, you know, and that the value pricing is supposed to be changing behavior, habits, timing, and those types of things. So, you know, in my mind,
so
there is a difference.
Okay.
But I think that the value pricing in the House Bill 217 was purposefully done because we can see we're using tolling and value pricing. We're not using one or the other.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there actually have been some distinctions made by the consultants. And so I think that's really important. I'm going to go to Representative Witt next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And share Representative Vile's concerns that value pricing may not produce the desired outcome. As someone whose home is reached either by I-5 or Highway 30 on a Friday afternoon when we had tolling on one lane, and the other two lanes supposedly open, I did not see any positive effect in the amount of traffic that was moved. What I saw was a limited number of vehicles using the tolled lane north and traffic congestion that was about doubled what it was prior to closing the one lane, and a whole lot of frustrated drivers. And it was so bad that Highway 30 was preferable to I-5. Now, when you're going through every little town along Highway 30 during rush hour, and that's preferable to using I-5, there's a problem, and I don't believe that the outcome has any desired effect. I can't believe it. And I'm a casual observer, and I was one driver.
You don't have to answer that. That was an editorial.
I would invite anyone to sit in the passenger seat with me and experience what it's like trying to get home.
I just want to say one thing. I'm not going to try and say that, you know, that the comments that I've made today aren't important, because they are. But I'm more of an optimist than I am a pessimist, and I'd kind of like to let them finish their work. And so I didn't have them come here, you know, to be grilled in a way that, and I'm not saying what you just said was not appropriate. It was totally appropriate, and you're the one that's driving that road. But I just want to say that I don't expect you to answer that as staff right now. We're giving you emotions, feelings, and we really want to let you know that we have questions, mm-hmm. and that those questions are real, and that they are important to members of this committee, and that we will be talking about it further as we see the final report. But please don't feel like you have to defend anything, because we are here to listen and learn, and we're here to make sure that you know what all of our questions are. Is that appropriate? Do you feel that we captured what you want them to do?
Madam Chair, if you're asking me, I don't know. They should not feel compelled to have to answer me at all. I was sharing my observations of several years of frustration.
And I appreciate that. And
on a virtually weekly basis, if
you.
Not daily.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, this is consistent with what we're hearing from the public, as you can imagine, as we're engaging this very extensive public outreach process. And it's interesting, when we talk to our consultants, it's exactly what every metro region in the country that has implemented tolling has gone through. In the Seattle metro area, they had that exact same conversation. You know, everybody very skeptical that it would work, that of all the impacts. And then what we find is that peaks right as it's implemented, and then people say, oh, well, maybe this thing isn't so bad. And then a gradual begrudging acceptance if we do this right.
And that's really important, the last comment that you made, and that is that it's not like we're the first one in line. Mm-hmm. Washington State has tolls and value pricing. And California also has tolls and value pricing. And there are some stories to be told that were successes and some stories of lessons learned. And so I'm assuming that both the consultants and ODOT are going to be making sure that we are providing that as part of the information given in that final report.
Absolutely.
And Madam Chair, my response to your observation is that I'm not pessimistic. I'm absolutely committed to the idea that we need to use value pricing. It's tolling, but it's a way to collect user fees on a very critical part of our social infrastructure, and to get our transportation, our freight, and our people moved, we've got to find the solutions. And I believe that tolling is one of those solutions. But I'm really struggling with understanding how the proposals that have been put together, other than that bridge proposal, that one makes sense. But the rest of them, I'm not tracking it yet. That's my observation.
And I appreciate your observation. And I don't think you're really pessimistic.
I'm not.
I think you're pretty optimistic most of the time. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I felt the need to clarify my earlier statement. It was not tolling. What it was multiple occupancy in the vehicle that determined that open lane. So I do need to clarify that record. But I'll leave it. I'm done.
Do you see how interested this panel is in this?
Absolutely.
And we're just going to be here with bated breath waiting for that final report.
Yes.
We know it's coming to Tammy, but we're interested. So.
That mirrors exactly what we're seeing with the public. This is probably the portion of HB 2017 that people are most engaged in. So you've certainly got the public interest in transportation.
Thank you very much.
All right. I will move on to my second topic, the Continuous Improvement Advisory Committee. You may recall this was also created under HB 2017, and this is an exciting opportunity to put together a group that can help ODOT continue to improve and become more efficient. There were three statutory responsibilities laid out for the CIAC in HB 2017. The first was very general, to advise the Transportation Commission on ways to maximize the efficiency of the department. The second is to develop key performance measures for the commission to approve and then report on their status to make sure that we're actually meeting the goals of those measures. And of course, key performance measures are ultimately adopted by the legislature as part of the biennial budgeting process. And then the third is to review completed projects over $50 million. The CIAC is essentially a subcommittee of the Oregon Transportation Commission, but has a slightly different role. So the Transportation Commission under statute sets the vision and policy direction for ODOT and the transportation system and makes investment decisions. The CIAC's role then is not really to make those decisions, but to look at our practices and to advise the commission on performance, efficiency, and effectiveness, making sure that we're executing those policies as efficiently as possible. The legislation directs the Transportation Commission to appoint members of the Transportation Commission, stakeholders, and ODOT staff to the CIAC. So we had a multi-month process of engaging the Transportation Commission in this process. And the commission really defined the skill sets that they were looking for on this group, particularly expertise in a variety of areas that they laid out that could really help ODOT to improve, as well as the ability to collaborate as part of a group. We had a very open public process, the commission putting that out on the street for essentially almost like a job application. We shared that broadly with stakeholders and had about 30 applications come in from that were really highly qualified, a lot of really great people. Ultimately, Chair Bainey and Director Garrett sat down and they went through those applications, all 30 of them, and they made a recommendation to the commission on the people they thought would help us and add the most value on that group. And they appointed these folks for a two-year term with a one-year check-in to make sure we've got the right membership on this group. So the membership of the CIAC is Chair Bainey of the Transportation Commission is the chair, and Bob Van Brocklin, another of our members, is the vice chair. From the external stakeholder community, we have Ted Odland, who's a retired general contractor. He was the former president of the National Associated General Contractors of America, and so brings a lot of expertise in the construction arena. Paula Hammond is a Cave Falls native and a Wushu alum, who is an engineer and the former secretary of the Washington State Department of Transportation and was recognized as a national leader in transportation. She chaired quite a number of committees of our National Trade Association, the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, or ASHTO. So she has a lot of experience in construction and project delivery and performance measures and such. Tony Hyde is a former Columbia County Commissioner who was the president of the Association of Oregon Counties and also on the board of the National Association of Counties. And then Dr. Andrew Koch is a professor at Willamette School. They're in their MBA program, who is a expert on lean processes and efficiency and also on supply chain management. So a good group of people who have a lot of very substantive expertise, many years under the belt in helping organizations improve. We have been, I think we also have some internal ODOT members who can bring their expertise as well. This group for the near term is going to be working a lot on our key performance, obviously, because that key performance measures, as that is one of the statutory directions. They have also been directed by the commission to take on our auditing function. Our audit committee that we currently have is now going to be incorporated into this group so that they see all of those audits and the opportunities for improvement that those provide. They are also going to be delving deeply into project delivery because we think there's a lot of opportunities for us to use them as a sounding board and advisory committee as we're looking to ensure that our project delivery processes are as effective and efficient as possible. And they're going to be looking at that general area of efficiency, including some of the things that came out of the DAS management review of ODOT, including our fleet and facilities and procurement processes. They had their first meeting in April, and they approved key performance measures that went to our Transportation Commission, which took them up last week and approved them as well for sending them along to through your process. And their second meeting is going to be in July, and they're going to take up our annual performance measure report to gauge where we are in meeting all of our performance measures and also really start delving into that topic of project delivery in depth. So with that, I'll wrap up, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about this group.
Any questions for staff? The only question I have was on your the audit function.
Mm-hmm.
So my understanding is that there's certain skills that auditors have. And so is there anybody on this? I mean, you're just looking at it as sort of a general review of the audit?
Yes. Chair McLean, we have an audit committee today, which, again, is being subsumed under this group, that includes our chief auditor and our audit staff as resources, and then has senior executives from the department who are engaged, as well as a member of the Transportation Commission. So that group now will become a subcommittee and report up through the CIAC, so they see all those.
They'll present to this
yes,
group.
Yes, they will present to that group. We also are ensuring now that the Transportation Commission is receiving and accepting all of our audit reports. So there's a direct line from our auditor and our auditing function to the Transportation Commission, as well as a line to this group, so they have those opportunities for improvement.
Other questions or comments? Thank you.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, I'm Hal Gard. I'm the administrator of the Rail and Public Transit Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I wanted to provide you with a update on the progress we've been making in standing up the brand new State Transportation Improvement Fund program. Throw up this little pie chart as a reference. I think everybody here is aware of the funding breakouts that were provided in House Bill 2017. I want to call out, though, that the numbers you see are significantly lower than those provided in estimates by LFO. There's two reasons for that. In conversations with the Department of Revenue, since it's a brand new tax that's going into effect July 1, they had concerns about 100% compliance in the first initial years of collection, and also that LFO estimate did not include the off-the-top administrative fees that DOR would be collecting. So these numbers we have provided in consultation with the Department of Revenue to our qualified entities as high-level planning numbers. We wanted to be in a position where we were under-promising and over-delivering, as opposed to having folks come out and actually have their project lists be oversubscribed. We are encouraging qualified entities to develop 130% project lists so that if more money comes in than this initial estimate, folks will be in a position to have more projects funded. So that is the rationale behind that. We have been working fast and furiously. We stood up a rules advisory committee who helped guide development of our rules. We had an extremely diverse membership, just represented just the groups that were serving in that effort. Progress to date. Fall of 2017, the OTC allowed us to appoint a rules advisory committee. That committee got to work in October. They worked fast and furiously and completed their suite of recommended rules in March of this year. And we presented those recommended, and they presented their rules unanimously. There was no dissent within the rules committee. We presented the entire set of rules to the OTC in both March and April, two separate presentations. They will be before the OTC for adoption or not at their June meeting in Lakeview. We've already held our public hearings on the draft rules. That was on April 17th, and the 21-day comment period has closed. So we're about ready to land that effort. Overview of the rules, kind of the key elements. So the STIF plans, this was a high recommendation from the RAC, is that those STIF plans or project lists are tied to a local plan. We didn't want to be too prescriptive, but we wanted to make sure that there's some foundation for the direction that folks are taking their development efforts. For very small rural areas, one of their first proposed projects can be developing a plan. To try to tier that, but we really wanted to see plan alignment across the board. Two advisory committees. We tried to provide a lot of latitude in terms of standing up the advisory committees that would advise and recommend to the governing bodies of the various qualified entities. Minimum composition of that advisory committee needs to include representatives from low-income households, seniors, and or people with disabilities, and a public transportation service provider. They would be the ones that review the request for funding. They would recommend awards for the set of projects to the qualified entities governing body. Again, those project lists would come to ODOT staff for review for compliance with the law and rules. It would go to OTC's Public Transportation Advisory Committee for their final recommendation to the OTC for adoption. That's how that works. So that's the decision-making piece. We've developed rules around reporting where the individual STIP plans would include anticipated service improvement outcomes. There would be quarterly progress reports from the qualified entities to us to allow us to track any issues or problems or progress as they move along. The providers would be required to report how service improvements benefit low-income households, how they would reduce fragmentation in service, how they would increase the frequency and reliability of service, both inside communities and between service areas. And then the recipients will also be required to submit budgets, the results of any financial audits, and they'll be required to undergo periodic compliance reviews by a third-party consultant. The funding cycles for this first round only, we're allowing entities to have two opportunities to submit plans. So for those qualified entities that are raring to go and have got resources in place, they can submit plans this fall. 6 months later, there'll be another opportunity for folks who need a little bit more time to submit those plans. We figure that first year out the gate. In subsequent years, we'll just have a single submittal period, and it will be aligned with our normal grant solicitation processes so that we're not working off step. Let's see. In terms of the discretionary funding opportunities, these are quite a bit different. So these are discretionary funds, and all public transportation service providers, not just qualified entities, are eligible to apply for these funds. So this expands the eligible list to entities such as cities, some intergovernmental entities, special transit districts, public corporations that provide public transportation services, et cetera. It'll be a statewide competitive process. Under the discretionary fund, purely discretionary fund, all types of projects would be eligible except for any ongoing operations projects. Of course, since it's discretionary grant, if you continue to fund ongoing operations, pretty soon you don't have any discretionary funds left. Under the intercommunity fund, all types of projects are eligible, but providers are highly cautioned that because of the discretionary nature and the competitive nature of the funds, that they should not be thinking about this as a guarantee for ongoing operational funding. So we'd want to see a funding plan, essentially. So if they're using it as a pilot, put together a grant for a pilot project, maybe we would fund it for, you know, a cycle, but they would need to have a plan on how they would go moving forward. Match was a topic of considerable discussion, and the RAC proposed a tiered approach to address concerns with making discretionary funds accessible to rural providers. And also we wanted to encourage fund leveraging, make sure that there's provider and local community project commitment, that type of thing, throughout. So applicants for discretionary funds are required to demonstrate an ability to provide a match of at least 20% to the total project's cost. A lower match rate of 10% would be for specified projects with certain characteristics. For example, providing connections between communities of less than 50,000, for filling a gap in the statewide network, for serving an area outside of a local transit provider's jurisdictional boundary, so if you're reaching out and connecting to another community, providing a statewide benefit such as a technology pilot, that if it was successful, it could be replicated across the state. Consistency with the Oregon Public Transportation Plan. Operational funding plans for sustainable operations that do not rely upon discretionary funding. And then all things equal, we're looking for geographic equity and ability to leverage other funds, particularly federal funds. One thing I just want to call out, for the initial rounds, we're anticipating for the initial discretionary funds that the primary consideration factors will be those listed in statute. So how are we targeting low-income populations? How are we increasing frequency or service area, that type of thing? But we recognize that as this fund takes off, since it's new, dependable funding, as systems become more sophisticated and complete, those criteria may change over time, and so we may need to target new areas. So let's say as the fleet ages out, that maybe we would put a higher priority on equipment replacement, mm-hmm. and maybe we would other areas in terms of the grant pieces. Of course, that's going to be up to the OTC and the direction that they would like to see. And I think finally, here's our next steps. We're looking at the OTC decision on the STIF rules in June. The tax on the program becomes effective July 1 of this year. First round of solicitations, we'll have applications out ideally the 1st of August. Let's see. We expect the first awards to receive the first round of applications November 1, so material out August 1, applications back in November 1, and then the first awards coming out in April of next year. That gives us two quarters of funds to disperse. And then in late spring, we'll bring the PAC recommendation for discretionary and intercommunity grants to the commission. And then in 2020, we will be happily in front of you reporting great successes. And with that, I will be happy to take any questions.
I just want to thank you for being here, and then I'm going to go to Representative Meek. And also, I don't know about you, but a lot of folks say, what is the criteria for all of this money going out to projects in our district? And I just think it's important for us to be able to answer that there are criteria, there is a process, and this is what it is. So Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quick question related to what kind of dollars we're looking at will be going out and dispersed through this program. And I believe it's from the House Bill 2017, is that correct?
Chair McClain, Representative, that's correct.
Is there a budget set from that, or is it a maximum?
So for the formula funds, so 90% of the money that is collected, essentially it is an entitlement with strings. So if you're the qualified entity based upon the tax that's collected within your area, upon approval by the OTC of that stiff plan, you are guaranteed that money. And essentially, the grant agreement is the acceptance of that plan, and that plan needs to contain fiduciary obligations as well as your plan for spending that money and what you would do if you're not able to. So there's a minimum base for small rural areas where they're guaranteed at least $100,000, but the idea was that most of the money goes back to where it was generated.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And you helped answer one of the other questions, but I like Representative Vile, served on the Clackamas County Planning Commission. We worked on a transportation system plan and prioritized projects. So some of those projects that may not have been funded through the general fund or the budgets that the county gets, maybe those are programs that we can apply for.
Chair McClain, Representative Meek, yes, if they are the type of projects that qualify under the terms and conditions of the stiff fund. So if it's capital improvement projects on a highway, no, they will not be eligible.
Right,
but if
right.
it's expanding transit service, that type of thing, absolutely they'd be eligible.
I'm curious. Okay, thank you very much.
Other questions? Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
So, Amy Joyce, I believe you're joining us with a check-in with the Autonomous Vehicle Task Force.
Chair McClain and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. And yes, I was asked to come in today and do a very brief check-in about the Automated Vehicles Task Force that was created in the 2018 legislative session. So this is a significant body of work actually to be achieved in the 6 to 7 months that occur between adjournment sine die of the 2018 session and the single deliverable required in that bill, which is a report to the legislature by September 15th of this year on recommended legislation around automated vehicles, also known as autonomous vehicles. The group needs to be recommending legislation in four specific topic areas. They are driver's licensing and vehicle registration, insurance and liability, law enforcement and crash reporting, and cybersecurity. And then at the option of the task force, they may also study longer-term effects like land use, employment, et cetera, and may report to the legislature in September of 2019. Almost all of the appointments have been made to the task force, so two representatives have been appointed. Chair McClain is one of the members. Representative Bowles is the second member of the House of Representatives, and the Senate has appointed one member, Senator Monroe. 27 of the 31 members of this task force were to be appointed by Director Matt Garrett of ODOT, and all of those appointments have been made. ODOT hired an independent facilitator to assist the task force in moving its work forward. Initially, the thought during session was, because of the very compressed timeline, that ODOT would conduct the facilitation on its own. However, as we got into the weeds on this a bit, the decision was to hire an independent consultant to facilitate. And one of the goals there is to have an expert in facilitation. Another goal, quite frankly, is that ODOT neither wants to be in actuality or perceived as directing the policy decisions that come out of this task force. So we went with an independent facilitator. We have already had the